Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Valerie Andrus, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, thanks very much to Valerie for introducing this edition of the Tennis Podcast. You can introduce a show yourself if you like, become a friend, and we have the option to introduce a show or to get a shout out. Shout outs are back today, folks. And the reason shout outs are back is because Catherine Whittaker's back. Hello, Catherine.
Hello. And that was me thinking I was never really away. But yes, in my most official capacity, I am indeed back.
Yes.
Have bounced. And bounced are bouncing back.
Indeed. I'm delighted to say Matt's here as well. And we're getting sight of Catherine today in her hotel room for the final few minutes of her stay in Indian Wells. What have you been doing this morning, Catherine?
I had breakfast with Billie Jean King this morning.
Of course you did.
In normal news, yeah. we had omelettes.
Somehow Catherine's only got sort of one more meal that she can have with Billie Jean King. She's had dinner, she had breakfast ticked off, there's only lunch remaining.
I'm available for lunch with Billie Jean King anytime. Yes, we both had omelettes. Hers was healthier than mine.
Marvellous. Okay, well, it's just the best news to hear that Billie Jean is still in our lives, not only in our podcast, but she's actually meeting us, ticking us off one by one. Matt's done an interview with her in the Billie Jean King Cup. Catherine's having breakfast with her. There's only me stuck here in Solihull. She doesn't show up here very often, so I think I'm out of luck. Anyway, we got loads of tennis to talk about since our last edition on Thursday. And it's all been a bit dramatic with both the men's and the women's tournaments finishing with Taylor Fritz surprisingly winning the men's title and Iga Świątek less surprisingly winning the women's title. Matt with a knowing look in his eyes because he picked it all along. But just before we get into the actual nuts and bolts of the tennis, Catherine, what's it been like this last 2 weeks of your life?
It has been pretty special, actually. I have really, really loved it. I'm ready to come home now because America is a wild, wild place. I really love it. I love coming here. I know we have a lot of American listeners and I don't want them to be offended because I love coming here and I've missed it so much. But it is a jungle out here.
More so in Indian Wells than other places that you've been.
Yeah,
you've been to a lot of places.
There's a local hotspot here called The Nest, which is a sort of if you know, you know type thing. It's like the club to go to. It's sort of a restaurant that's also a club, which is a genre of evening entertainment that doesn't really exist in the UK. If you're going to a club, you're going to a club. It can't be a sort of you're going out for dinner and maybe if you want to dance afterwards you dance. No, this is that's it's this it's that rather. I thought we've just got to tick this off before we leave Indian Wells. Everyone's always talking about The Nest. So off we toddle last night after dinner at Cactus Jack's. I didn't shy away from having a cliched California time, I had short ribs and they were delicious. And I also vinegar with my chips and I got looked at like I was a freak. and then, so then off we go to the nest and my jaw was on the floor for my whole time there. It was truly extraordinary. You got sort of, well, men that are claiming to be 21, but one can only assume that they were using some kind of fake ID, sort of grinding up against women in the later stages of their life. It's sort of wonderful in some ways, sort of clubbing for all ages. There's a man dressed as a clown who's just there, and he's there every day, apparently. He's just there. Yeah, it was really wild. The security guard, whose main job, he walked around with napkins under his feet, mopping up any spilled drink, which I appreciate because, you know, a sticky floor is the sign of a grungy evening, isn't it? It's a red line. Oh, no, that's his job. It's a red line between grungy evening and, you know, evening that you can tell your parents about. So he's walking around with napkins under his feet, sort of dancing as he goes so that people don't really notice what job he's doing. But he's just got two guns on his hips, a gun on each hip.
Okay.
Wild. Absolutely wild.
Oh, come home, Catherine.
And how was the tennis, Catherine?
Yeah, I didn't talk about the tennis today. The tennis was great. I loved it. Yeah, what more can I say? It's been really, really great. I wasn't here in October, so I don't want to speak for the people that were. And I think, you know, as with everything that happened upon tennis's resumption during the pandemic, we were just grateful that it was happening and delighted that it was happening. But it was different and inferior, just like tennis without crowds was different and inferior. But we were grateful for it at the time. Well, you know, Indian Wells is back, and it was resplendent, I think. I'm obviously incredibly biased because I was there and I've got a tan, but it really felt like a jewel shining in the sun again.
Going to start with Matt's triumph, and that is Iga Świątek beating my pick for the title, Maria Sakkari, 6-4, 6-1 in the final. It was I don't want to say wind assisted, but wind affected, certainly, again, Matt. And this, I mean, this has been the theme from the last couple of days. I always remember Indian Wells being windy, but these last couple of days seem more extreme than ever. But I was really impressed with the way Świątek handled those conditions. She seems like she's moved to another level to me. Is that the sense you get?
Yeah, it is rather. And I think, crucially for this match, it's the sense that Maria Sakkari gets as well, because Sakkari had dominated, to be honest, their head-to-head last year. I think they played three times and Sakkari won all three. And they've played twice now in 2022. And Świątek has won both pretty easily, both in straight sets. And Sakkari said she's a different player. She has changed the way she plays in terms of her aggression. She's more aggressive than ever. She's sort of taking the racket out of my hand. And I think Sakkari said that all very well, because that's what I'm seeing when I watch Świątek play now. There's a commitment to her shots, which I think she's had sort of at her best before, but she's sort of got it all the time now. And at the same time, there's a really good mental approach that, yeah, she was in tricky conditions. She knew it wasn't going to be an absolutely perfect match that she was going to play. She accepted that. She didn't get bothered by making a few errors. She just was kind of perfect in those conditions. And yeah, I was really, really impressed. And she sort of kept up this amazing run of form she's on, A, but also B, this run of incredible finals she's had. You know, she won 12 of her 13 sort of pro finals, that sort of WTA and ITF level. She's won the last five, beating top players very, very convincingly. She plays her best when it matters, and that's such a such a skill to have. Yeah, I'm so impressed by Świątek this year, and it does feel like she's gone up a level. And this is probably not even her favourite surface. I mean, there's probably not much to choose now. She's become so good on hard court, but to think she's still got the clay to come, it's sort of building up to be a really exciting season for Świątek, I think.
Yeah, I mean, she seems to me once she's broken the back of a match as well, because she got broken to love in the first game of this contest with Sakkari, but once she'd just found her feet, and this seems to be a theme of these big finals, once she's comfortable, watch out, because her toolkit is so expansive anyway. She's got so much she can do, but it felt almost as though she just put some of it away and just decided to just meet every challenge with brute force. And I mean, look, Sakkari brings it, doesn't she? And she brought it yesterday. She was trying to hit Świątek off the court, and Świątek just stood up to it totally. I mean, I felt she did a great job with the wind of sort of neutralizing that as an impact. But I don't know, she's able to handle pretty much any kind of game. And what I like, I mean, I like her demeanor generally, but I mean, you, Catherine, got a first-hand experience of that demeanor. It was one of the lovely features of the role you had of presenting live TV, but literally on the court. At the end of the match, you're there, you're wrapping up what's gone on with your pundits, Martina Navratilova and Greg Rozetsky, and then over wanders Iga Świątek. what is she like?
Well, exactly as you find her, exactly as, you know, your impressions of her would lead you to expect, I think. Completely unassuming. But with this sort of steely core and determination, you know, you don't beat Karolina Pliskova love and love in a 1000 final without a ruthless streak. And yet she's just a delight. I love that contrast. I really do. I think Martina Navratilova, I mean, she's a big fan of Iga Świątek's anyway, as you might expect, or probably would definitely expect. But she's a huge fan of her new coach, Thomas Witorowski. You're both nodding at me. Well done, me, for that pronunciation.
They worked together, didn't they?
Well, yes, when Martina was sort of mentoring Agnieszka Radwanska, she worked with him. And I've never actually heard her speak so highly of a coach. She said if she had to choose a coach right now, she would want to be coached by him. And that's massive, really, isn't it? And we know that the project for Świątek, and she talked about this, Matt, so openly, didn't she, in a few press conferences of hers we attended in Australia, is, you know, trying to get over her perfectionism. And after she lost in the Australian Open, she said, I feel okay about this because I know I played well, and I've got a lot from this tournament. I've learned that I can still play not so well and win. And I think that helped her to not panic today when she did get broken to love in her opening service game. She was really nervous out there, and kind of as soon as she was able to eliminate nerves from her game, as soon as she loosened up, the match was hers. But I think past Iga Świątek might have panicked a lot more in that situation and just gone, oh, it's not going to be my day. It's not going to be my day. I've woken up on the wrong side of the bed. It's all is lost. Exactly as you've both said, and as Maria Sakkari pretty much said, she's changed and she's gone up a gear. And I really, really want Ash Barty back on tour so we can see them go toe-to-toe. You know, Świątek herself referenced her rivalry with Sakkari in her post-match speech. You know, she said, I think we've got a rivalry going, and that's great. And it made me think about Naomi Osaka a couple of years ago saying, you know, I really want a rival and I want these rivalries. That is the only thing missing for me from women's tennis at the moment. We're not seeing these players at the very top meet enough. You know, bring back Bianca Andreescu, please. We have seen Instagram posts of her training at the IMG Academy this week, so hopefully that's not too far off. You know, I want to see Barty against Osaka, Osaka against Andreescu, Andreescu against Świątek, Świątek against Goff. I want to see, you know, Muguruza and Halep in the mix. I just want to see all of it all the time.
Yeah, me too. And actually, I think especially Barty, look, I absolutely understand why Barty is taking the breaks that she is taking. And if she didn't take these breaks, I don't think we would have Ash Barty at all. So it's very important that she kind of does take them, I think. But I did miss Barty a little bit, you know, just because obviously tournaments are bigger than players and we had so much great tennis. But it does feel to me like Barty is the ultimate test right now. Can your game compete against Barty's? Can it go up against Barty's? And, you know, we're not getting to see that quite at the moment. And that does detract a little something. It's not a big problem because there's so many other great players and great matches. But seeing Świątek play the way she played just got me all the more excited about the potential for Świątek Barty, because I think Świątek's coming on. I think she would have a game that can go up against Barty's. I mean, I think they played recently at the start of the year, actually, and Barty won pretty easily. But already it feels like Świątek's come on in these last few months. She's got confidence. She's understanding this side that Catherine talked about, you know, putting her sort of perfectionism to one side sometimes and accepting what she's got on the day and playing with that. She's making so much progress. And, you know, Świątek's world number two now. And, you know, I want to see her go up against the world number one, because that's a great potential match, I think, right now.
Mm. And whilst she may be putting the perfectionism aside in order to stop her kind of becoming paralyzed by that, there's still a voracious appetite to her to get better. She's not satisfied, is she? She's not, I won the French Open, that's the tennis I'll play, that will do. She put that onto hard courts and grass and got a certain return on it, didn't she? And it was a decent return. She has not flopped in any way since winning that French Open, but she hasn't reached those heights again, apart from these one or two massive finals where she's just destroyed the opposition. But this is the first time that it's happened at a Masters 1000 in Indian Wells, where everybody, okay, not everybody else is there, but most players are there. I mean, she had to do it the hard way to win this title. It's blooming difficult to beat the players that she beat. And it feels like she's definitely moved on to another level. And I mean, look, she won Wimbledon Juniors as well. This is a woman who I sense that she wants it all. She wants to, and you see it in those celebrations, Catherine. I mean, those were amazing moments when she won those two, that the semi-final and the final, the way she just threw a racket up into the air and just, she's kind of unassuming on one level, but also not letting that hold her back. She just brings it.
Rafa-like. He's her idol, of course, who she fist bumped on the way off court.
Oh, really?
After her ceremony, yeah. Nadal and Taylor Fritz waiting in the tunnel to come out for their final.
That's cool.
And there was a lovely, lovely moment there, like big brother, younger sister. And I get the feeling that Iga Świątek feels the way I do after breakfast with Billie Jean King when she has an encounter with Nadal and he treats her like they're equals and just fist bumps her like it's nothing. I imagine she sort of goes home and goes, what just happened? Which is lovely.
Maria Sakkari had a big semi-final win over Paola Badosa, and that was a good contest for as long as it lasted before Sakkari started to have her own way in it. And I similarly loved her reaction to that, the emotion that she had in her eyes when she was being interviewed afterwards. She was tearful but so proud that she'd made this next step. But how do you come out of this tournament now, Matt, thinking about Maria Sakkari? Have we seen a significant move here, or does she still have a problem because she's not making the final step yet?
Yeah, I was going to ask you this, actually, given that you picked Sakkari to win the title and sort of how much progress
Do you see what he did there, David?
The final. Oh, yeah, that was deliberate.
Was skullduggery.
All right, then. Well, I mean, look, I was delighted with having her in the final, because I did, even though I look at the list of players, I actually chose her because of the surface and the conditions. I felt like the high bouncing ball, to me, she's just another one of these perfect clay court specimens. Strong, fit, huge topspin, power, massive kick serve. To me, she's perfectly set up to win the French Open one day, but maybe just a little bit inflexible at times. So that's why I went with her. But when she got into the final, honestly, I was, because of the pick that I'd made, I was sort of willing her to win and trying to come up with a way in my mind that she could win, whilst actually thinking if Świątek plays her best tennis, she will lose, because Świątek just feels like she can handle it. And and then when the wind started blowing, she couldn't control her shots often enough. And I mean, I love that kind of paddled staccato backhand she hits. She sort of bunts it, doesn't she? But incredibly powerfully. But it goes very low over the net. And they showed the sort of difference in net clearance between the two players in the graphic, and that thing was just not controllable in any sort of sustained way. And so I'm encouraged for her, but I do think there's a problem, because until you win one of these things, I think there is a danger that can build up in the mind and become a bigger obstacle in the future.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, she's world number three now, Sakkari, which has sort of snuck up on me a little bit, you know, when you consider that she hasn't done the winning of some of the other top players on the WTA Tour. It's one career title still for Sakkari, and that was Rabat in 2019. You know, it's not a big title by any means, but I do still see this tournament as a step, as you've said. I think there's still a lot more progress she can make, and I think will make, but I see this as a step, mainly because of the semi-final win, because that has so far been such a huge obstacle for her. I think the reason she was so emotional afterwards was because there's been a lot of baggage there. She'd lost 12 of her last 14 semi-finals on tour. And
wow,
there have been some big ones, you know, Rome, Miami, Roland Garros, US Open, Guadalajara at the WTA Finals, you know, a lot. So she needed that breakthrough. And I think she got that breakthrough against, you know, the defending champion. And she really won it. She went out and won that semi-final playing really good tennis. I maybe naively thought that, you know, having broken that barrier, oh, you know, the floodgates are going to open and she's done it. But I still think there's another step to make, and that's getting herself more regularly in finals and trying to win them. I suppose I give a little bit of a pass for the final, as you said, David, because of those conditions. They were so extreme and not suiting her game at all. But yeah, I think overall it's a really, really positive fortnight for Sakkari, absolutely. But I don't think she would be content with saying, okay, she's done it now, because her ambitions are much, much higher than even a great week like reaching the final of Indian Wells. She wants to be winning the big ones.
I do wonder, though, you know, whether she is just a victim of the class that she's in, the sheer number of world-class players that would fit into any era and be competitive. And if you stuck Sakkari in certain other company, I think she might be winning some of these. But when push comes to shove, she's not as good as Barty and Świątek and Osaka and Andreescu. There are things she can do really, really well, but she doesn't have all the options that they have, I reckon.
Yeah, I think that's the size of it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, I would say I think she's almost there to capitalise, because she's so consistent, you know. And Barty, we know, takes breaks. Okay, Świątek's really consistent at the moment, but Osaka and Andreescu are not always there. And it does feel like, you know, yes, these are great, great players, but there are also opportunities on the WTA Tour to win big. And she's constantly giving herself a chance, which is what I like.
Catherine, there was a conversation you had with Daniela Hantikova where Daniela was saying that she found semifinals harder than finals. And when Matt was reeling off that incredible stat of the amount of semis that Sakkari's lost, did you get a sense as you get an explanation from Daniela as to why she found that harder in the semifinals? Because I heard her say it and I couldn't quite work out what the reasoning was.
Well, she said you feel like you have more to lose in the semi-final. You know, once you're in the final, there's, you know, in terms of matches to be played, there's nowhere else to go. You're giving yourself the maximum opportunity, but it feels like the semi-final is the place, you know, where you fall at the final hurdle in a strange way. As Martina said, and Greg agreed with her while we were talking just before the trophy ceremony in the men's final, she said, oh, losing in the final is the worst. At least if you lose in the semi-final, you don't have to sit there during the trophy ceremony. You can just go home. And I always think that. I mean, it's just painful. Painful. Yeah. Anyway. But I think it's probably quite hard to explain the psychology of why the semi-final is harder eloquently, but I just sort of instinctively get it. I sympathize with that. I can imagine in that alternate universe where I am a professional tennis player that reaches high level semi-finals, I too would find it'd be most nervous ahead of the semi-final than ahead of the final. It's like the you know, if it were Olympics, you'd be playing for a guaranteed medal, wouldn't you?
Ah, that's your comparison. Many have agreed with that. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, and I suppose it does depend on personalities to some degree. But I thought the women's tournament was absolutely brilliant all the way through. I really, really enjoyed it. It was a perfect microcosm of why the state of the sport is in such rude health at the moment. Hologic have chosen a good time to come on board.
And it was really interesting. They, you know, it doesn't seem to be just talking the talk about, you know, them being the perfect sponsor for the WTA and it being sort of a meeting of this perfect alchemy of branding. You know, they had already set up a, you know, women's health screening station next to the accreditation office. By the players' area for available for all of the WTA players to come through, you know, bone density scanning, cholesterol, all of that important stuff, you know, and that's I didn't see that in PR anywhere. I don't think that's they're doing that, you know, for PR purposes. I think that is really walking the walk. And yeah, it's early days, but all signs are incredibly positive, I think, for that partnership.
Well, that's great.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The ATP men's tournament, well, it ended with an enormous surprise because, I mean, really the whole thing was building up to that match between Rafael Nadal and Carlos Alcaraz. We'll talk about that in a moment or two. But Taylor Fritz stole in and won the whole thing. And, I mean, I think we've spotted signs of fairly significant improvement in him over the last couple of years. He's felt like a coming player and probably the one of the American players who's been the most likely. I thought it was going to be Tiafoe when we started this year, and that win that Fritz had over Tiafoe in Australia really took me by surprise, and particularly the way he did it. And he's an interesting character because there's been a lot of hype a number of years ago around him, and then it felt like that hype, quite honestly, was misplaced to some degree, and I questioned whether he was going to be bothered enough. You know, he was obviously having some results, and he got sponsors, and he obviously not struggling for money and all the rest of it. But what was very clear in the last 18 months, I feel, or at least since coming back from the pandemic, is that this guy really does want it. And he is trying, and he's happy to come over to Europe and play on the clay and get points and figure it all out. And he's got Paul Anacone with him, and he's got Michael Russell, who's a real workhorse of a coach, sort of week to week as a former player. And this was a fantastic win, not only to because of who he beat in the final. I know Nadal was compromised physically, and we'll talk about how Fritz was compromised physically as well. But I was just really, really impressed that he was semi-finalist in October in Indian Wells, and he's come back and he's gone and won the whole thing. It's very impressive, Catherine.
Absolutely. And yes, Nadal was compromised, but most players would have lost to him yesterday, regardless of that. 100%. And Taylor Fritz could very easily have lost to him yesterday. I think he might have grown fangs. I don't know if that's possible. That's a conversation we need to have with Mary Carrillo, the author of the fang
theory.
Can
you grow fangs mid-career?
I think he has. I did not think this guy had fangs a few years ago. I thought that's what was missing, and perhaps he was overhyped because of where he was from. You know, if he'd been from, I don't know, insert literally any country here, would he have been as hyped as he was, you know, being from a country that's just desperate to sort of resume their lineage in the men's sport that's been just used to so much success over the years? I don't know. But even aside from that, you know, he's obviously got talent in terms of his game, huge talent. I don't think he worked, you know, as hard as a lot of other people were at the same stage of their careers. He's lived a lot of life for a 24-year-old. He's got a baby, I think. Well, not a baby, a 5-year-old-ish, I think. He's been married and divorced. Mm. He's got a long-term girlfriend now who's a TikTok star, David. She's trying to bring tennis to a new audience, which, all power to her. Good luck. You know, good on her. It must be a very strange life, just travelling around the world with your partner. Obviously, lots of glamorous perks to it, but to give herself some, you know, some purpose and some meaning to all that, you know, great. Try and bring tennis to the masses. Brilliant. And he came over to speak to us after the win. He was in a state of dazed disbelief. You know, he's really likable, and he sounds like he's sort of tranquilized. He's so, you know, Californian in the way he speaks. Oh, I just can't believe it. But that, you know, in the words that he was saying, there was real fangs. He said, I said, what now for you? And he said, it's really important that I'm not satisfied with this. This isn't enough. This is amazing. It's a dream come true, but I am not going to be satisfied with this. And I just don't think there's any way a few years ago Taylor Fritz would have been saying that. And he might be, he's either the exception that proves the rule, or he's evidence that it is possible to grow fangs.
And I think we've got a pretty direct example of how much he's grown in the last year, because we saw Fritz play an injured Novak Djokovic at the Australian Open last year. That was the match, I think, in the third round of that tournament where Djokovic hurt his abdominal muscle, and it was also the match where the crowd left halfway through, and it was all strange. And Fritz initially got it back to 2-2, and I can't quite remember what we said at the time after that match about Fritz's performance in the fifth set, but I don't think it was positive.
I don't think it involved fang compliments.
No, absolutely. I think we probably called his tennis a bit immature, probably, because he didn't play seemingly the right way against an injured Djokovic, who was kind of there for the taking in that set. Anyway, we then had him play an injured Nadal in the biggest match of his life, the Indian Wells final. And I agree with you, Catherine. I think I was watching that match thinking, okay, the worst player to face in this situation is a fully fit Nadal. But an injured Nadal is probably in the top 3 or 5 as well of difficult opponents to face. And the second set proved that. Nadal made that really, really tough. And every time Fritz responded brilliantly. You know, Nadal had several break points in that second set. And I think only on one of them did Nadal do something that he would want back. Otherwise, Fritz took it from him. He ripped it from him with either a big serve or a big forehand, which I think's improved a lot. And I thought he played the right way. I thought he played with confidence and with intent. And he went out and won that match. And I was kind of blown away by that performance, actually, even bearing in mind Nadal's injury, which, sure, was a factor. I think Fritz was still so, so impressive.
And there is some concern over this injury for Nadal. What he did, he seemed to get some sort of twinge in the previous match against Carlos Alcaraz around his left pectoral, didn't he? His sort of chest and rib injury. He had Per Bastot, the trainer, come on and kind of click his back. He got him face down and made his back click or something like that, and that seemed to help. But when he came out here very quickly, it was obvious that he'd got a problem. He was three love down within minutes, and he just didn't. He looked ratty the whole first set and a half, really, as though he was just a bit done with it all. I mean, he had won obviously 20 matches out of 20 this year so far. Obviously, things have been going incredibly well, but he looked fed up. He looked as though this thing was hurting, and he looked as though, frankly, he was questioning whether he was going to even bother carrying on finishing this match. And then the fighting spirit kicked in, didn't it? And he went all the way to the line. I mean, he got 5-4 up in that second set tie break with a mini break. And that's the moment that I looked at Taylor Fritz. Because I knew the result when I woke up, because I fell asleep during this match for the last two games and watched the end of it this morning. So I knew the result. But at 5-4, I'm thinking, well, hold on a minute. How does Fritz win it from here? Because he's 4-5 down. The crowd's going crazy. Nadal's pumping the air like a celebration, as in I've got this now, and it doesn't happen. And I was massively impressed, Catherine, the way Fritz, what he actually did. He turned around to his coach at 4-5 down, and he said, "Come on," not like, "Oh, it's all going wrong." It was more of a sort of, "Come on, I can still do this." And I thought, good for you. That's really impressive against Nadal.
Absolutely. Same as both of you. I was really blown away by him yesterday. I think Paul Anika, I mean, Michael Russell is as well. And I think they're a good complement to one another. Good sort of set of a coaching twin set. But I think just, you know, a bit like Murray was saying with Lendl, I think just Paul Anika saying yes and wanting to be on board the Taylor Fritz train, that must give him a lot of confidence. You know, the fact that someone like Paul Anacone believes in him, because he's not going to mess around and waste his time with somebody that isn't going to show the right commitment and the right potential. I think that's really big for him in terms of belief. I think Nadal had changed. This is Martina Navratilova's observation, but he'd changed his technique a little bit. He was hitting the forehand later in order to change the sort of torsion in his upper body, which, once pointed out by one of the greatest players of all time, was very obvious to me. But obviously, in a million years, I'd never have spotted it without it being pointed out by her. It is all going to make one heck of an episode of Serve to Survive, or whatever it'll be called, on Netflix. I was sat below. I just came up with that, actually. I was sat below the Taylor Fritz player box for that match, and at the risk of sounding like Stefanos Tsitsipas, I think I'm going to be on Netflix because there was a Netflix camera trained on them the whole time, and you can just imagine how that storytelling is going to go, isn't it? I mean, Taylor Fritz injured his ankle in his semi-final against Rublev, and then that was on Saturday, so only 24 hours rest. He comes out Sunday morning for a hit, and he screams out in agony, said it was the worst pain he's ever felt, curtails that practice after 5 minutes, gets it all taped up, comes out and practices again at 2:15. Everyone's speculating at about what time exactly Taylor Fritz is going to pull out of the biggest match of his life. I heard speculation that Ben Stiller might be called upon to play an exhibition in order to please the crowd, which was not a prospect I was looking forward to. And then out they come. And as you comment, I'm not throwing you under the bus here, David, because I thought exactly the same. But you said Taylor Fritz looks sad
as he walked onto court.
He did.
I felt so sorry for him. When he went 3-love up a few minutes later, I remember thinking it was bizarre, maybe it was just nerves. But no, I really believe it was sadness.
Yeah, it was. I mean, he did not expect to be competitive out there today. He said, "I don't know what happened, but my ankle felt okay." He said, "I've got an MRI booked for tomorrow. There's a big chance I'll be paying for it. I don't know about Miami. All I can tell you is my ankle was okay for the 2 hours of that match today, and I can't explain why." But honestly, if you were trying to script an episode of the Netflix show, you couldn't do much better. I wonder what they'll call it. I just watched an episode of Drive to Survive, which had the name Dances with Wolf, in reference to Toto Wolf, the Mercedes team principal. So I hope, I don't know, answers on a postcard if you can come up with the name of this Netflix episode, because it's definitely getting an episode. And like Stefanos Tsitsipas, I think I'll be in it.
This is Fritz's thing, is it? His trademark, sort of miraculous comebacks? Because he's the guy who had meniscus surgery and 3 weeks later was winning matches at Wimbledon. Now he's experiencing worst pain of his life. Hours later, he's beating Nadal in a final.
Yeah, and he's got this extraordinary deciding set tiebreak record. Obviously, he didn't need that in the final, but you unearthed this stat, Matt, that at all levels, he's won 19 out of 22 deciding set tiebreaks. And when I dropped that stat bomb on Martina on air, thanks very much, Matt, the face she made, I've never felt so good about myself. She was A, impressed by the stat, and B, impressed by Taylor Fritz. She said, "Wow, that tells me something about him that I didn't know. That does not happen by accident. That tells you something about Taylor Fritz."
And I wonder whether at 4-5, mini breakdown in that tiebreak, that's where it comes into play. This inner belief, this inner steel that he doesn't shirk when he's facing down a challenge like that. And I mean, just to talk very briefly about his game as well. I mean, got to see a lot of it this week because he went all the way and he was on the big matches. Got to see how explosive he's made that forehand. I mean, he's looking to take people out. There was the first game he played against Andrei Rublev. Yeah, you know how hard Rublev hits the ball. He hit one forehand that smashed into the tape that had the crowd laughing at it because it was just so dismissive of Rublev's power. It was kind of, I don't care where this goes, I'm going to hit it as hard as I can. And he's got a thundercrack of a shot on that forehand. And when you had him after that match chatting away, Catherine, with you guys, he was very defensive and protective about his own backhand because some reference about how good good his forehand was. And he was like, "Well, I like my backhand, actually." And when you watch that backhand up against the Nadal cross-court forehand and the damage that shot does to everybody else or so many other people, and that backhand was standing up to it comfortably. He was taking them on the rise. He was just swishing them cross-court back, or he could turn it down the line. It's such a clean hit. And, I really, really enjoyed watching the guy. It's fantastic. And I noticed as well, he said about when he turned it, he was feeling the ankle in that practice. He said, "I was trying to act tough so that people," and he said, "people were thinking that I'm maybe exaggerating this because of how much I screamed out, but I was actually trying to act tough and not scream out." So goodness knows, I didn't read the press conference transcript, but I was thinking, you know, I wonder whether he's had a major cortisone shot or something like that, that, as he says, when it wears off, forget Miami, no chance, but I can get through 2 hours.
And thanks to a very strange glitch in the ATP rankings, he briefly made his top 10 debut this morning, because the ATP accidentally counted all the Indian Wells points twice. So he went up all the way to number 8 in the rankings this morning, but actually he is number 13 and he still has to wait to make his top 10 debut. But I thought that was quite amusing.
Very amusing. What about Nadal? I mean, the story of his run to the final from when we last spoke, Matt, he played Kyrgios and he didn't lose to Kyrgios, as I said he would. Lots of people have been reminding me of this. But it was the usual, wasn't it, really? A very up and down emotional match. Kyrgios was absolutely brilliant for an hour. And then he lost his mind a few times and behaved pretty badly at times. And then he behaved absolutely abominably after match point because he smashed his racket into the ground. It was unintentional that it flew off and nearly hit a ball kid in the face. The kid actually had to move a step in order for it to avoid hitting him at a real rate. When that eventually surfaced on social media, Kyrgios addressed it, set up some sort of meeting with the kid, videotaped it, and put it out on social media to show himself giving the kid a racket, which was his attempt at an apology. But Nadal's performance, it felt like he was managing all of these situations. And then he ends up playing against Carlos Alcaraz in the semis. And I mean, in terms of the contrast the kind of contest between the two of them, it did not disappoint. It was everything, right from the moment before the match where Alcaraz was doing these jumping jacks right on the spot, right in front of Nadal's face, you know, his knees up to his chin. He came out and broke him immediately. He was hitting the living daylights out of the ball. He was knocking Nadal off the court, frankly, for a couple of games. And then things settled down. Nadal goes on a run of 4 games. And then a hurricane arrives in set number 2. I mean, Catherine, just give us an idea of what the atmosphere was like ahead of that match, because it looked crackling. It looked electric from watching on TV to see Nadal against Alcaraz. I mean, Matt had sent us this front page of Marca, the big Spanish sports newspaper, which had got the two of them on the front cover, hadn't it? But what did it feel like to be there? Did you feel like Indian Wells was on to Alcaraz already before that match?
Oh, yeah.
And what was it
big
like
time.
once it had finished?
It's such an informed tennis crowd in Indian Wells. You know, a lot of them are people that have travelled from goodness knows where to be there. And you don't do that if you're sort of casually interested in the sport. Indian Wells knew about Carlos Alcaraz and yet was also still intrigued and in the end surprised by Carlos Alcaraz. There was a sense of huge expectation and also the unknown about that match, and I'm just so relieved that it didn't disappoint. In fact, I think it in some ways it over delivered. It's overwhelming, the support and goodwill that Nadal has in Indian Wells. I hadn't really appreciated it before this year. I mean, obviously he's popular wherever he goes, but there does seem to be something a bit special about his relationship with this tournament. He rides a tidal wave of support and emotion whenever he steps out onto court. I mean, it wasn't even close, the relative volumes of the receptions for Nadal and Fritz as they walked out for the final. It was, yeah, different gravy for Nadal to what it was for Taylor Fritz, and he's flipping Californian. But yeah, I spoke to. Sorry for name dropping here, but I spoke to Billie Jean King about this match this morning, and she tweeted about it as well. She said it was one of the best matches she's ever seen, and she says that for a bunch of reasons, but one of them is the fact that set two was played in a sandstorm, because as Billie Jean King says, champions adjust, and she loved seeing them having to adjust and problem solve out there. I know lots of people will feel differently about watching that second set. I find it quite stressful to watch wind play, and that's because I am a terrible wind tennis player. In fact, I'd just rather not ever play tennis than play tennis in the wind. It's it's cruel and unusual punishment. I consider it basically a different sport. So I guess I'm sort of projecting and feeling that anxiety. But there was just an element of, you know, marvel about watching them figure it out. I mean, we've got two players here, particularly Nadal, whose shots bend in the air anyway. Add in a sandstorm, and we're talking swirly wind here. You don't know where it's coming from. It feels like it's coming from all directions, like it's, you know, you're being kettled by the wind. Yeah, it was pretty extraordinary in all the ways.
I thought it was a really special night and a match I will remember for a long, long time. And I learned a lot about Alcaraz in that match, especially in that second set, in the windy set, because, you know, I think of...
I was surprised by that.
Yeah. I mean, I think of Nadal as the best wind player I've ever seen. You know, someone who has the right mindset, doesn't feel sorry for himself in the wind, has the margin on his shots. He's set up to play in those conditions. And actually, it was Alcaraz who dealt with it better. You know, that's as flustered as I've seen Nadal in the wind. And his game got worse in that second set, very, very understandably. Alcaraz's game somehow got better because he was pulling the trigger a bit too early on shots in the first set. He was making some errors, and he made fewer errors in a hurricane than he did when there wasn't a hurricane, basically. It was kind of remarkable, the second set, and that really got him into the match. And then in the third set, I mean, both of them were just phenomenal from the first few games until the end of that set. Some of the rallies were unbelievable. And what sort of sticks out most for me is, you know, we know Alcaraz is this incredibly exciting talent. You know, Nadal said he prepared for that match like he was playing a top eight player. That's what he considers Alcaraz already. And, you know, that was Nadal himself years ago. He was precocious. He was talented. But Nadal won this match through his development as a player. You know, he won this match because he can do things now that he didn't used to be able to do in terms of volleying. His net coverage was unbelievable, with his reflexes tight on the net, coming up with volleys that frankly you thought he'd miss, that he would hit for winners. His backhand is better than it ever used to be, and it just kind of showed, I thought, you know, Alcaraz is already amazing, he's already great, I'm so sure he's going to have a good career, you know, touch wood, injury doesn't affect him. But Nadal just sort of reminded him down the other end, you know, if you want a legendary career, you've got to keep evolving and keep improving, because you've got to get to the kind of tennis that I'm playing. And I just thought that contrast between the sort of youthful, promising Alcaraz and the guy who's already done it for 15, 20 years was kind of fascinating to watch play out.
Mm. And I get the sense that Alcaraz is going to relish that development in his own game, because he's already trying to add serve and volley into it and stuff like that, which is an amazing thing to see a young lad with a baseline game like that prepared to do already. But I agree with you. I mean, it was Nadal just delving into everything he's ever done in order to find the answers, and it was just intoxicating as a contrast. And also the moment that the wind dropped, and then it was like they said, right then, let's go for it, lads. We can stop hitting it down the centre. Let's tee off for half an hour, see who's got it.
Yes, it was like that moment in an F1 race where they get rid of the safety car and they were just unleashed suddenly. It was like a sprint to the finish. God, it was amazing. And look, Nadal, look, I know he lost the final, but he has enriched and lit up this first few months of the tennis season. I'm really in complete awe at what he's done. His best ever start to a season at his age, having just come back from, you know, a really career-threatening injury. And yeah, I've enjoyed watching him so, so much. And I'm kind of fascinated by what he does about the clay now, you know, given he has had an injury here, the foot has also been a problem. I don't know whether he's going to play his usual full schedule on the clay. I would think he would try, but it's going to be interesting to see what he does about the clay over the next few months. That's going to be another kind of fascinating element to Nadal's season, I think.
Yeah, because he's not going to play Miami. He's due to play Monte Carlo, then Barcelona, then Madrid, then Rome, the usual. So, yes, we will watch with interest and bring you all of the movements as they take place. Right, the doubles tournaments. Jack Sock and John Isner won their second Indian Wells title together. They also won in 2018. Heck of a run to the title. They beat Nikola Mektic and Mate Pavic in round one. Nick Kyrgios and Tanasi Kokkinakis in round two, so that's the Australian Open champions and the multiple Grand Slam champions in the previous round. Stefanos Tsitsipas and Feliciano Lopez in the quarterfinals, Zverev and Golubev in the semis, and then Gonzalez and Roger Vassalan in the final. I mean, Jack Sock, in the words of John Isner, Catherine, best doubles player in the world, hands down.
That's a burn, isn't it, for the special Ks who are taking a momentary break from changing the sport.
Now, you're going to help me with the names of the women's doubles champions, Catherine. I've got them written down in front of me, but I'm really not confident. You've been saying them all week. Who won the title?
Zhu and Yang, the first all-Chinese pairing to win a title at 1,000 level. And they were a joy to watch, actually. Zhu, in particular, she was a magician out there in terms of what she could do with her racket. It was, it was a really classic doubles watch. And they beat Asia Muhammad and... Who was Asia Muhammad's partner?
Ina Shibahara,
yes. But Asia Muhammad is the one I'm thinking of because she's just been on a ridiculous tear recently. She was unbeaten in singles and doubles across 20-ish matches,
27.
I think. Most of those are ITF level, it has to be said. But, you know, wins are wins. And, you know, she reached the final at a 1,000 level with Ina Shibahara. And they were a scratch pairing for that tournament. So, and they took a break early on, and it looked like, you know, the role would continue. And Zhu and Yang were incredibly impressive to turn it around. And that's quite a big deal, you know, first all-Chinese pairing to win at this level. So, ones to watch.
Yeah, very much so. So Miami is starting tomorrow, the WTA event. The ATP event starts on Wednesday. A couple of draw highlights here. Amanda Anisimova against Shelby Rogers in round one. Naomi Osaka could face Angelique Kerber in round two. It's like this all the time, isn't it? Just Grand Slam champions facing off. Talking of which, Emma Raducanu against Simona Halep is a possible round three. In the ATP event, Novak Djokovic is, by the way, he's back to number one in the world. Of course, he's not playing Miami, but he's got himself back to the top ranking. Daniil Medvedev needs to get to the Miami semis to get it back. Could face Andy Murray in the second round, could Daniil Medvedev. Murray faces Federico Delbonis in the first round. And a quarter that has Stefanos Tsitsipas, Carlos Alcaraz, Felix Auger-Aliassime, and Taylor Fritz, unless he withdraws. They're all in the same quarter, which is a really packed little section of the draw. In the Davis Cup, the four cities for the group stages in September have been announced as Glasgow, Bologna, Hamburg and Malaga. Canada have received a wild card in replace of Russia, who've been banned from the competition, the defending champions or the reigning champions, having lost 4-love in the qualifying. They have still got in, Canada. And that has raised some serious eyebrows. Marty Fish, who's the US captain, tweeted, "Wait, what? You lost 4-love in the qualifiers. What's going on here, Davis Cup?" And Andy Roddick agrees and says this is a really dumb rule. They're determined to make it a full-on exhibition. It's... I just can't be doing with wildcards in the Davis Cup. It's really as simple as that. And I think if they didn't have wildcards, they'd get themselves out of all sorts of trouble, really. But anyway, that's the situation we have. We have a mascot. Let's move on to that, because that's a happier note to end this tennis podcast with. Who is it, Matt?
It is Shadow Waddo. I think I'm saying that correctly.
Right, Shadow Waddo.
Shadow is an 11-year-old Labrador retriever. owned by Dan and Andrea, and Shadow is lovely.
Thoughts, Catherine?
Very lovely. Extremely lovely. I mean, I'm a sucker for a Labrador slash any canine. But yeah, I'm a sucker for a Labrador. Rosie's half Labrador. Bella, her previous dog, was full Labrador. And Shadow is ticking all the boxes. Shadow Waddo. I misspoke. Yeah, lots and lots of loveliness. And Dan, Andrea and Shadow Waddo are from Pasadena in California, which is a place I've heard a lot about this week. I've been working with all sorts of people from all over the jungle that is the United States of America. And one of them was from Pasadena, which apparently is a lovely place. So I'm sure Shadow Waddo is leading a lovely life there.
Marvellous. As is Darwin, despite the fact that we were crushed by Maria Sakkari's final defeat and Carlos Alcaraz losing in the semis, Catherine has Carter as her mascot. Matt has Gerald the Cat. Billie Jean has Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have Chris Albert Lee and Carl Weingartner as our executive producers and very much top blokes. And we also have the return of Shoutouts, Matt.
We do. An exciting moment after two podcasts without them. We have today Sally Wells from Cape Town.
Hey,
hello,
hi Sally.
Hello, Sally.
Like Alan Wells, the 1980 Olympic champion.
Yes, I think I might have almost been called Sally. I think Sally might have been an alternative name that my parents were considering. Mm. Hello, Sally.
We have what I am actually called, Matt Thomas, who is from Sydney.
Right, Matt.
Well, we like Sydney and we like Matt's and we like Thomas's. Thomas Enquist, yeah. Lovely chap.
Indeed. Thanks very much for
Muster.
Being a friend of the Tennis Podcast and getting yourself a shout out. Who's our third and final, Matt?
We have Daniel Bergston, who is from Stockholm but now lives in France. And he describes himself as a devoted tennis dad and tennis taxi driver for his two sons.
Aww. I'm sure that is very relatable for a lot of tennis parents out there. Thank you, Daniel. Daniel Evans is still what Dan Evans is called on the ATP website, isn't it? So there's your tennis, Daniel. And also Taro Daniel.
Very quick thinking, Catherine. Daniel, thanks ever so much. Thanks to all of you for being our friends of the Tennis Podcast, which if you're not already one of them, you can join the gang and you can listen to all of our additional podcasts that we've got just for friends. We've got another one recording in the next couple of weeks for friends' questions, which are coming in by the boatload at the moment. I mean, they're coming in on email, but, you know, I'm saying there's lots of them. And yeah, you can chuck yours our way as well if you become a friend of the show. You can get a shout out. You can get an intro. Catherine is off to board a plane to return to this green and wonderful land. And it's actually sunny here at the moment, Catherine. So, you know, we're doing our best to sort of break you back in gently.
It is much appreciated. I hope from now until forevermore I can just bounce from one summer to the next.
Okay, we'll like work on it. Player. All right. Mm. Okay, well we'll be back with another tennis podcast as well a week from now. Miami will be underway and we'll be with you for it. See you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.